I'm a trained immunologist, and for long I believed that there's a close mix between mitochondria and the immune status of an individual. And so what we started doing was we started looking at different age populations in terms of their mitochondrial health of the immune cells. And so what became very clear is, again, most people know as we all age, similar to the muscle trajectory, your immune system loses its ability, right? So that's why you don't respond as good to vaccination, or you catch more flu or other kind of diseases in your 60s and 70s.
It isn't about being perfect. It's about being better. Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Stima, and I host expert discussions with thought leaders in all facets of health, including nutrition, fitness, hormones, stress management, performance, recovery, longevity, health span, and energy production. On this show, we discuss complex science, but then we also alchemize it into actionable everyday living. The ultimate goal with the show is to assist you in making informed decisions about your health and to catapult you into being the hero in your own life. Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And today I am bringing you a fantastic conversation on aging well and a compound that I think is a game changer. Now, I don't use that word often. This is one of those times where it is an appropriate use of the word game changer. We are talking about urolithin A, and my conversation today is with Dr. Anurag Singh. He is currently the chief medical officer at Amazantis or Mitopure, which is a biotech nutrition company based in Switzerland, and they are working on developing the next generation of natural compounds that target improvements in mitochondrial health. Dr. Singh, over the last 7 years, has led the clinical development program at Mitopure for this urolithin A compound, which is a natural mitophagy activator, which is just fancy speak for getting rid of senescent cells. This has led to the work of several branded products. There's Timeline, Mitopure, there's skin products as well that help with the appearance of aging. Dr. Singh himself has received his medical training in the internal medicine from the Armed Forces Medical College in India. He has a PhD in immunology from the University of Connecticut in the United States, and he has authored 30 articles in many of the top peer-reviewed journals and holds 10 patents and has designed and led 40 clinical trials over the last 15 years. So what did we talk about today? Well, we talked about mitochondrial health. We talked about urolithin A. Why do we care about this compound? And where is it produced in the body? Who produces it? Who doesn't produce it? And what are the contributions that it has to aging? So we talk about a couple of different important systems. We talk about the immune system. We talk about muscle, musculoskeletal health. We talk about the diet. We talk about heart health, skin care, brain and cognition, and spine and joint disorders. And not surprisingly, of course, because of all those systems relying on mitochondria, when we have compounds like urolithin A that drive up mitochondrial production, whether it's the number of mitochondria, the efficiency of the mitochondria, or mitophagy, which is basically cleaning out of old cells that aren't working the way that they should, then all aspects of your life get better. So you're going to really enjoy this conversation. And what I will share with you is after we stopped recording, Dr. Singh shared with me that he is really dedicated. I was saying to him, I really, really appreciate the R&D, the research and development that your company puts in, because it's very odd for supplement companies to be all in for the science in the way that they are. And he was like, yeah, it is, you know, it's tough. And it's from a consumer perspective, sometimes they're looking for the cheapest supplement, you know, in the plastic bottle that you can buy at Costco or whatever. So really, really happy that he is committing to differentiation and having some of these conversations around why mitophagy and the research and development that they're doing at Timeline is providing such stellar results. So please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Anurag Singh. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point, we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Bond Charge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure. And that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to bondcharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week, per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com. All right, Dr. Anurag Singh, I am just thrilled to welcome you to the Better Podcast. Welcome.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Stephanie.
I've been looking forward to this conversation because we are going to be talking about a compound that maybe some of our listeners are not familiar with. It's called Urolithin A. It's something that has captured my attention as of late. I've been using your, from Timeline Nutrition, MitoPure, both the supplements, and we're going to talk about the skincare products as well. But before we kind of get into some of that juicy stuff, let's just talk a little bit about what is this compound, Urolithin A, what is it, where does it come from, and maybe we can create a case for why we all should really care about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So yeah, gosh, 15 years of research led us to this journey. So we started with this idea of bringing the biotech approach to nutrition, sort of the deep dive into foods that have a lot of health benefits. So we started with the pomegranate. And the pomegranate, as you know, probably has a lot of health benefits. It's, you know, from different ancient cultures, it's been sort of seen as a fruit of gods, et cetera. So we started looking into the pomegranate.
It's a symbol of fertility as well.
Exactly. Yeah, so a lot of health benefits. We started looking at the clinical literature around pomegranate juice, extracts, and really mixed data. And we started looking at all the bioactive compounds. Now, pomegranate has hundreds of bioactive compounds. And so we when I say biotech approach, we actually started looking at all these hundreds of compounds and starting to figure out which one of them was responsible for this sort of superfood status that you get on the pomegranates. And we zeroed in on these antioxidants or polyphenolic compounds called pineocolagins or elegitanins. These are polyphenols that are found just not in pomegranates. They're found in raspberries and in pecans and walnuts. So essentially all the good stuff in the Mediterranean diet. And we started studying these polyphenols. And what came to, it was actually a sort of serendipitous collaboration with a professor just across the street. We are based out of the Swiss Institute of Technology. We gave him these compounds. In addition, we also kind of added in some of the metabolized products. And now these polyphenols, that, once you are taking a glass of juice or eating a bowl of berries, for example, your gut microbiome will harness these, digest them, and release certain other metabolites. These get into it. And one of them was this compound, Urolithin A, and we added them into the mix. It was thought initially that Urolithin A was basically a waste byproduct of this metabolism through the gut microbiome. And so we gave all these compounds to this famous professor, Professor Johann Olrichs, who's been basically behind the discoveries of resveratrol and NAD boosters. And he came back running to us saying, what is this molecule? Because none of the other compounds are doing anything, but this one is really extending health span and lifespan of different models that he was working with. And so that started the journey, and that's how we got interested in Urolithin A. So Urolithin A is basically, for your listeners, it's really what I call a postbiotic. So it's the end product of the metabolism of a lot of dietary components that are found in sort of fruits and nuts, such as pomegranate and nuts. And it's really this gut metabolite, this postbiotic, which is what is key for the health benefits of a lot of these fruits and nuts.
And so one of the things that I've heard you talk about is that there is a wide variability in the population at large in terms of their ability to produce this postbiotic. So we're having these polyphenols, and then it really is dependent, as you mentioned, on the gut microbiome to be able to produce this postbiotic. So are there any ethnic or regional areas in the world where we see a better production of Urolithin A? Are there genetic SNPs that someone might have or might not have that would give, that would predispose them to better or worse production of this postbiotic?
Sure. Yeah. So we have looked at it almost different parts of the world. So we've looked into the French, we've looked into the Canadians, a lot of studies in the US population, US healthy adult population. And it's fascinating. About, I would say, in the best case scenario, we see about 30-40% of the healthy adult population show some levels of Urolithin A coming from dietary exposure. Now, some people are what I call blessed ones. They convert very well. So almost 1:1, they'll convert the precursors to the Urolithin A. Somebody like me, growing up in India, a lot of antibiotics. Now, I can drink 6 glasses of juice. My body just refuses to make this molecule. And so in
France,
that's
the antibiotic use?
Yeah, antibiotic disrupting the gut microbiome for life, probably. And it's very difficult to reconstitute it back to what is the healthy sort of, quote unquote, the healthy microbiome status.
Okay. So even though you're of Indian status, let's say, or Indian ethnic origin, the use of antibiotics has potentially disrupted your ability to produce your Urolithin A.
That's my hypothesis. Yeah. Because I tried eating all kinds of healthy diets, fermented foods. My body just refuses to make this molecule. And that's why you need to think about calibrated dietary supplementation through this molecule and other sort of gut molecules that are reliant on the gut microbiome, the digestion. So in the Americans, we see only 10-12%. In the Canadians, it's similar. Now, it may be difference of the food habits of Americans and Canadians versus the French and the Italians, where we see more of 30-40%. Yeah, that's what we run a study actually in Chicago, 100 people, gave them a glass of pomegranate juice, and we only saw about 30-40% could convert, even if they were provided the right diet. Mm-hmm. Now, back to your question on what is the difference, I think boils down to gut microbiome diversity and richness. And we have tried to study for at least 5 years, what is that gut bacteria that is key to it? And in the end, we haven't really succeeded, because I think it's just not one bug. It's really the ecosystem, because the gut microbiome is so complex. You really need perfect harmony of gut microbiome. So I see this as a postbiotic Urolithin A, which also is like a biomarker of perfect gut health. So if your body has the right gut microbiome and you're eating the right diet, you will make it.
Yeah, so this is really bad news for our Americans and our Canadians with that 10 to 12%. That's a horrible number. I would be interested, it would be interesting to see, because I myself, I'm in Canada right now, of course, travel and have lived in the States as well. It will be interesting to see if you take someone who has lived, let's say, in the United States or Canada for their entire life, and we measure them and see, oh, there's like a 10 to 12% capacity for producing this postbiotic. If we then transplant them, as my long-term plans are, which is to sunset in Europe somewhere, in Italy, Portugal, France, it will be interesting to see if there's sort of, I mean, maybe this is too cost prohibitive, I don't know, but to see if there's any up leveling in the capacity for Urolithin A production, because there's so many things that go into, you know, you mentioned antibiotics, which are just, you know, you have a sniffle and you get a prescription for antibiotics here. There's glyphosate, which is used on our crops, and all the sorts of things that are sprayed where, you know, places like Italy, I know specifically Italy, I follow it because my husband's Italian. They're very protective of their food as their hair, you know, to protect the sort of heritage. So they have certain you know, even lineages of wheat that are different than the wheat that's used, let's say, on North American soil. So it'd be interesting. I don't know if this has ever been studied or if you've ever thought about it, but if we change the environment, whether or not that would have a prolific effect on the capacity for urolithin A production.
It's a fascinating, and probably we haven't done the transplantation because that doesn't fit with the whole nutrition and dietary sort of strategy. But I am aware there are research groups, one at the Buck Institute of Aging, that just won a few years back a multi-million-dollar grant to do exactly what you're proposing, is if you could transfer the gut bacteria that are conducive to urolithin A production into models of experimental animals, which are not, and if you could recover a lot of deficits in mitochondrial dysfunction that accumulate with aging, like memory loss or mobility. So It's not a bad idea. We have developed a test that can allow you. So we have taken a very simpler approach. I have developed a test, a very simple blood spot test. It just requires you to prick your finger, spot a few drops of blood, and you can drink a glass of juice that, you know, you can buy. Comes with the kit, actually, or you could try taking a bowl of berries and nuts and see if you're making it or not. And then you can actually see what your baseline is, because that's also missing today in the nutrition field, right? Everybody's popping with omega-3, but you really don't know where it's all going. So if you really need. So that's what one thing we are approaching. The second thing we are looking at is where in natural sources is present. So we've actually looked into breastfed mothers and tried to see if giving certain glass of juice during breastfeeding, if the molecule will even show up in the breast milk. It's and it shows up in 30-40% of the mother's breast milk. It does show up. So, you know, we probably all lived a very, let's say, vegetarian, vegan diet, hunting fruits and eating fruits and nuts, and our gut microbiome has just shifted, as you said, you know, from probably everyone back in the days in our evolutionary history produced these molecules, but we've just slowly lost the ability. And it's found in Iberian ham, for example, because believe it or not, these Spanish pigs are eating a lot of fruits and nuts that are given by the farmers here in Iberia. And well, I don't want to speculate that that's what makes Iberian ham so tasty, but yeah, that's kind of the origins of the molecule.
That's amazing. Well, let's talk a little bit about what are some of the benefits that urolithin A has on longevity, on inflammation, on extending health span. And I'll be referencing, so in preparation for our conversation today, I was telling you in the pre-chat, I pulled up your paper that you and your colleagues had published in Cell, so Blue Ribbon Journal. This is not just like a run-of-the-mill, it's one of the sort of top tier journals, and we'll link this out in the show notes, but the title of the study is The Impact of Natural Compound Urolithin A on Health, Disease, and Aging. So I would like to talk a little, let's maybe start with some of the metabolic benefits that we see with the consumption of urolithin A, and we can get to, and then I would like to maybe move into skeletal muscle as well.
Sure. Yeah. At the base of the discovery is that the molecule urolithin A boosts mitochondrial function, right? And the way you can boost mitochondrial function today from the existing knowledge we have in the field is you can boost it three ways. You can either increase the number of healthy mitochondria. This is a process that a lot of people call as mitochondrial biogenesis. And there are compounds such as NAD boosters and resveratrol that do it. And then second way is that you can take the pool of healthy mitochondria and you can make them more efficient. So they're producing more currency of energy, which is ATP. And there are, again, compounds like CoQ10, which hit this sort of more efficiency pathway of the mitochondria. The third pathway, which is also very well conserved, where till we discovered urolithin A, no molecule ever described to hit on it, is a process called mitophagy. And that's essentially the garbage disposal pathway of the mitochondria. So mitochondria, over time, they accumulate a lot of waste and they become poor. Their health status becomes poor. And with aging, this accelerates. And so you're now left with a cell that has a lot of faulty mitochondria that it cannot clean out. And so that the space is being occupied, much like your garbage bin in your house. If you don't clean it out, your house will not smell. And so that's what urolithin A does, is it revs up this cleaning process of the faulty mitochondria. And that cleans out the waste, it gives more space, and your healthy mitochondria come in and you get better mitochondrial health. So at a metabolic capacity, that's the core sort of MOA mechanism of action, how this molecule works.
I think that is so awesome. So there's three ways, as you mentioned, just to recap. There's like the number of mitochondria, so you can create more. So you were saying like NAD, resveratrol, urolithin A would be comprised in that group as well. The efficiency yep. of the mitochondria, so CoQ10, and then mitophagy, which is the, you know, if you just think of, for my Greek listeners, phagos means eating, right? So like the so we're basically like consuming the mitochondria that are no longer, you know, maybe efficient. Maybe, as you said, they've accumulated so much debris that they're not working as well as they can. And so this is, you know, a parallel to autophagy, which we hear with fasting, we hear with caloric restriction. So when we think about mitophagy, these are, so those would be some other ways that we might induce that would be caloric restriction, extended periods of fasting. Are there any other ways that we might, just in terms of lifestyle, that we might think about? I mean, it's hard to, the thing that I sort of struggle with generally with autophagy and sort of the fasting conversation is like, well, the longer you fast, the more autophagy you have, the more mitophagy you have. It's like, well, how are you measuring that? How is that being measured? So maybe you can walk us through urolithin A with its influence on mitophagy. How is that being measured? And then maybe you might outline, is it dose dependent? Is it like, you know, the frequency with which you're dosing with it? Like, talk to us about how we're measuring an improvement in mitophagy with urolithin A, either supplementation or if you're giving, you know, if it's back to the Iberian pigs and we're just giving them berries and nuts.
Yeah. So, you know, so we've taken a stepwise approach. We went into worms. We actually did all the head-to-head. So the first models in which a lot of anti-aging compounds, or let's say compounds that have a effect on the aging rate, are studied is these worm models, because they age pretty fast and you can study. So we did benchmark to caloric restriction, and you're correct, caloric restriction is the holy grail. It can improve and improve health span by about 50%. Resveratrol and other compounds are shown to do it by 20%. There are drugs like metformin, which is involved in glucose given to diabetics. It does it about 40%. The reason we decided to venture and put more effort into urolithin A, we saw about a 45% improvement in sort of health span and autophagy and mitophagy. Now, how do you measure it? There are a lot of tools available to scientists. Of course, as you go from worms to mice to humans, the set of tools become lesser because there's so much lesser you can do in humans. So in our trials, we measure mitophagy. Either we take peripheral blood immune cells, we look at their mitochondria, and usually the mitochondria that are not in a good status, they will put this eat me signal up front. And so that's what you were saying, is that these faulty mitochondria, they tag themselves to be eaten, but it's just that the rate slows down so much with aging that, you know, you can't maintain the balance. So what urolithin A does is it basically revs up the process. And now all these mitochondria that have put these receptors, one of them is a molecule called parkin, actually. And so that comes from the Parkinson disease that happens, which is a classical autophagy disorder that happens with aging. And it removes these parkin, and that allows more near mitochondria. And that also we can measure through things like genes like PGC1-alpha. So we see more PGC1-alpha going up, and we see parkin induction, which is a sign of mitophagy. And then we can measure the oxygen consumption rate, which is a sign of whether it's in muscle cells or in muscle biopsies, because we've translated it into humans, or in immune cells, or the peripheral immune cells, blood immune cells. So we can look at that ways into how better the mitochondrial health is.
And one of the things I read in your paper in terms of metabolic function is urolithin A supplementation attenuated, so I'm just reading this, just this little piece from your paper, attenuated yeah. triglyceride accumulation in the liver, reduced total cholesterol, low density mm-hmm. lipoprotein, and adiponectin plasma levels. So yeah. without a change in body weight. So yeah. I believe this was in rodents, but I mean that in and of itself, so not changing mm-hmm. anything about the environment. So you're not making the rats exercise more. You're not giving them fat, like you're not fasting them, but just the supplementation of urolithin A. I thought that was really fascinating, where we saw an improvement in the lipid markers of these rodents. And I thought that was pretty cool, because that's something that we really, as we age in particular, women as they go through menopause and men as they go through andropause with those declining sex hormones, one of the things, particularly estrogen, one of the things that we see is sort of this dyslipidemia and this sort of cardiovascular disease onset that affects both men and women, certainly at different points in their lives. But I thought that was a really poignant finding. And I wondered if you might expand on that in terms of if you've seen, have we seen that in human, have we looked at that in human trials? And then what is the dosage that we're talking about that's going to elicit, and of course for rodents, it's going to be different for humans, but what's the dosage that we're thinking about for humans in order to elicit a similar response?
Yeah, so, you know, of course, we've done a lot of research, but there's a lot of famous scientists now working on this molecule. And so the paper you talk about is really the summary of the state of the art of the field where, so essentially, wherever my organs that are extremely rich in abundance of mitochondria are going to get impacted, right? So you have the skeletal muscle, the most, one of the most abundant, the neurons in the brain, this is the cardiac cells in the heart, and then the liver and the kidney cells. These are the five organs or five cell types that have highest abundance of mitochondria. So with aging, I mean, it doesn't, we all know that, you know, one of the first organs that get affected is mobility or ability to be attentive and memory loss, then all the metabolic disorder. So obviously a lot of effort and research has gone into sort of these five sort of categories. And so what we see is in different animal models, we have tried to translate into humans, but mostly focused on muscle because, again, as I mentioned, muscle is easier to assess. The tools in clinical research are easier to assess. The doses we see the effects happening in humans is around 500 milligrams. That's what we see if we, after a month, if we were to take the biopsies in sedentary older adults, these are 70 years old, who were supplemented with 500 milligrams. We would see a lot of mitochondrial gene signature in the muscle that would suggest a lot of mitophagy and biogenesis happening, similar to what an exercise regimen would do in that same time frame. And then in 2 months, we see effects on muscle strength and endurance. And so in addition to your question on the lipid profile, a lot of the studies we do are in older adults and sedentary overweight. And so these are markers we are looking at. One of the key hallmarks we see in addition to, of course, the is impacts on sort of these biomarkers of lipid metabolism. So that's absolutely key. And the second is inflammation. And that's where I think you may have heard about these hallmarks of aging that people talk about a lot in this longevity field. At the crux of this hallmarks is mitochondrial dysfunction that connects inflammation, lipid dysregulation, almost all these hallmarks.
It's the linchpin. It's the thing that connects them all. Yeah,
exactly. And it's amenable to the interventions, right? So you can improve mitochondrial health versus telomere attrition or you know, all these dysregulated nutrient sensing, which are much, or stem cell exhaustion. These are much tougher to tackle from an interventional trialist perspective. And so one of the hallmarks, as I was saying, we see is an impact on inflammation. You measure CRP in almost every trial. Older adults are super inflamed. CRP is low. Overweight folks are inflamed. We see CRP go down. And this effect manifests at about 1,000 milligrams. So the sweet spot is about 500 milligrams to a gram, a few way.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
Let's touch on muscle a little bit because we talk about this a lot on the show. Certainly, I'm a big advocate for resistance training. I talk about it all the time. One of the things, of course, that we know as we age, and my audience will be very familiar with this, is they're like, oh, here she goes with muscle again. But, you know, this sort of sarcopenic presentation where we see this fatty infiltration of the muscle, we see a total loss of muscle volume. as we age, this anabolic resistance that kind of sets in, which is related to insulin resistance, but essentially the muscle becomes less sensitive to signals like protein, which is why we need to increase our protein as we age, that kind of thing. This can also be related, of course, to the myocyte, you know, the mitochondrial density and receptivity and efficiency in the muscle cell as well. Can you talk a little bit about some of the results that you've seen with urolithin A supplementation on skeletal muscle?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, as I started off saying, when we thought about how to go forward and translate this into, of course, more advanced aging models in humans, we selected muscle because two reasons. One, muscle is a very metabolic organ, and so it's much easier to assess. And so one of the first findings was that we improved grip strength, which is like muscle strength, and then endurance by about 40-45% and strength by about 10%.
Grip was 40%?
10%. Grip strength by 10% and endurance by about 40% in these advanced, older rodent models.
Yeah.
And so then we went in and we did the study with older adults who were sedentary, so they don't move around, and we gave them urolithin A for 2 to 4 months. And what we saw was we improved it both the hand and leg endurance. So we looked at hand. So the kind of exercises we gave is like a leg press test. You know, most of the older adults, if you do repetitive muscle testing, they'll fatigue. And so you're looking at how long can they do the test. So they had 20% better endurance. And then we saw about a 10 to 12% improvement in muscle leg strength in this trial. So that's, to me, is strength, as you said. You lose about 10% muscle mass and strength with each decade of life after your, let's say, mid-30s, right? So, and this gets double accelerated once you hit 60. So a lot of what we are seeing in older and geriatric populations is, as you mentioned, rightly, can be fixed if there were earlier intervention strategies. And I think urolithin A is part of that conversation now.
Yeah, I often, what my observation is, usually the largest acceleration of aging starts around 40. So we start to like not kind of feel ourselves 30, 35, 37, 39. And then if you're not strategic and careful between the years of like 40 and 50, there can be such a unprecedented decline in quality of life. So this is where I feel, you know, when I'm thinking about what are the clinical applications of urolithin A, I think certainly everybody needs to be resistance training. Every woman, every man, everyone listening here should be resistance training at some frequency. So, like 3 is good, 4 is better in terms of like frequency per week. What about when we look, whenever I'm taking my blood work, which is about every 6 months or so, what I know to do is I know to lay off the resistance training for like a day or two prior to getting my blood drawn, because my LDLs go up, because, you know, that's a wound, you know, it's a wound substrate, it helps to sort of repair muscles. The other thing that always goes up when I'm, if I don't take time off of training, is my creatine kinase levels. Did we see, were there any changes, let's say, with these sedentary individuals? Did we see an augmentation or an attenuation of CK? So creatine kinase, just for the listener, is basically, it's breaking down. It's sort of, you know, it's a marker that your muscles are sort of either repairing or you've just done a really crazy workout and there's some breakdown that's happened. Did we see any changes in creatine kinase in these individuals? Was that measured or looked at all?
So not in the older adults, because we didn't, I mean, this was just a 5-minute, you know, incremental test where they do it in a few minutes. Most of them, after a few minutes, they give up. We did see in multiple models of dystrophy, one of our collaborators looks at muscle dystrophy, and they found that urolithin A was attenuating creatine kinase levels. And so we've gone in and actually done a study now in elite runners, basically going from overweight, sedentary older adults all the way to young 25, 30-year-olds.
With the best mitochondria. they're going to have those elite athletes.
Supposedly the best mitochondria, because believe it or not, overtraining, a lot of them do overtraining, and overtraining does induce muscle damage and as a result, mitochondrial damage, and they are all inflamed. And so it's unpublished. This is data that is fresh out of the press. But the primary endpoint was creatine kinase, because in these athletes who do a lot of high altitude training, you see the spike of, as you said, the creatine kinase is a marker of muscle adapting to training, and then it peaks up And so if it peaks up too much, that means your muscle is getting too damaged. And that's usually a sign for these athletes that, that they need to either lower the training or do some other adaptation. So we see that giving these even elite athletes for 4 weeks, MitoPure attenuated the creatine kinase. So the recovery was better in these athletes.
So we can use MitoPure, which is the supplementation that contains urolithin A. We can use MitoPure as a recovery tool.
Absolutely. I believe that's where a lot of our new data is coming in. And that's what I believe I'm hearing a lot from consumers who are, you know, big proponents of and using that their recovery is something to focus on. And they, a lot of our early adopters, as I call them, are amateur athletes, weekend warriors who do biking and dirt gravel racing and things like this. And they swear by it, that their recovery is much faster than what they were, you know, most of them are in their late 40s, early 50s. They swear by it, that they're even beating the records from 30s. So I actually believe part of the reason, I think, is muscle attenuation, but inflammation is a big component as well.
Yeah. And I think that even just my own personal end of one experiment, my recovery also, as I'm in my 40s now, is different than it was in my 20s and 30s. And I think our ability to recover just, I think, naturally attenuates. It naturally decreases, you know, over the delta of our lives. So something that you might be able to take in supplement form, or if you're able to derive it, let's say, from the berries and nuts, if you have the gut microbiome that's able to produce it, I think that's also a really smart strategy. Because if you're recovering better, that means that you can get back to the gym earlier, you're reducing your propensity for injury, for overuse, for that CK level, that creatine kinase level, as we've been talking about, to sort of peak as well. So when we're thinking about supplementing, specifically as it relates to, like, if we're thinking about urolithin A as a recovery tool, and redirect me here if I'm off base, but would you think about taking it after? So there's like 500 mgs that you're saying, this is sort of the standard dose. So we're taking 500 mgs. Would you think about that, taking that after a training session or before? Or when would be, if we're trying to optimize our skeletal muscle, which we all should be doing, what is the, so we have the dosage, the 500, and I think you were saying for like really sedentary adults, it's like 1,000, it's like a gram. In the studies, but what is the timing like? We have the dosage. What is the timing look like?
Yeah, I mean, in our studies, we haven't split it as pre or post workout. The athletes are taking it first thing in the morning, you know, and they take it continuously over a period of 4 weeks. But I think it will work great as a post workout tool, because that's where you're kind of getting the damage and the inflammation set in. And so, definitely in the post. I mean, I'll give another anecdote here. So the scientist, I did this trial recently in Australia. She also works with all elite athletes. And there is this particular elite athlete who was getting he's a basketball player, actually voted MVP in NBA recently. This gentleman was getting injured a lot. And he was put on MitoPure, and his recovery is much better. His injury rates have fallen down. And now he's, of course, at a very high performance level. And so, he, you know, typically the dietitian that I talk to, that team, say that he gives it every day in the morning to all the athletes. So I don't think there's a set regimen there, but I think it would work better as a post-workout. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, for sort of transparency, that's how I've been using it. So I will go to the, and it works especially well after leg day. So if you're someone who splits up your workouts into body parts, as I do, you know, leg day is brutal. Like, I am sore the day of, I'm really tired. And then the next day I'm either fatigued, or if it's a new work, you know, some new exercise, new movement pattern, I'm usually sore. And yeah, it really helps, at least for me. And this is, again, just my own experience with it, but I really like it post workout. So I have like my post, you know, my protein shake or whatever I'm having after I work out, and then I'll take it then. I mean, it still tends to be in the morning because I work out in the morning, but it's coming after, like, I'm putting the supplement after my exercise, because that's sort of how I've been viewing it. And just the data that we're talking about today in terms of it being a recovery tool, it just makes sense to me, whether that is right or wrong, to take it afterwards. But what you're describing here with the NBA player, it seems to be like you just have to take it. Like, it just has to be in your, it has to be in your 24-hour period. It has to be taken at some point in order to sort of reap some of the benefits.
Yeah, and we don't have the data, but one of the populations we're targeting is the injured post rehabilitation population, right? So taken, this is a study actually happening in McMaster in Canada, Stu Phillips is a famous protein scientist. And what he does is basically puts a knee brace that kind of mimics it, like putting a fracture or immobilizes
the joint. Yeah.
Yeah. And that in 2 weeks induces about, you lose 10% of your muscles. So that induces very fast muscle atrophy. And then the standard of care right now there is just high protein supplementation, which usually works if you get these people moving with some sort of, you know, physiotherapy. And so the goal is, can we combine high protein supplementation with urolithin A at these efficacious doses that I was talking about? And can we boost protein synthesis rates? Because people forget protein synthesis is all happening at the mitochondria.
So right. By
boosting mitochondrial rejuvenation or mitophagy in these settings of muscle atrophy, if you can boost the protein synthesis, then you can, as you mentioned, even in older adults, you can probably even break this anabolic resistance of aging. So that's the thought. That's what we are doing. Happy to share the data.
Has that been published yet? Has that research, or is it ongoing?
Study, but we have done that. We've already done these experiments in rodent models where you can do similar things that reduce and increase the mitochondrial protein synthesis rates, suggesting that we have a high chance to succeed in this setting.
Nice. I want to jump to spine and joint because we're in muscle land. So let's just go to spine and joint. I think that's also, you know, because all muscles have to attach somewhere, right? They attach to bones. There's, you know, they cross joints. One of the things that it seems to also do is it seems to also slow down the progressive damage to the intervertebral discs, which are sort of the cushioning in between all the bones. Can you speak to, is it collagen synthesis that's being upregulated, the proteoglycan? Like what is happening that is protecting the disc? And then the other place I'd like to talk about is osteoarthritis, which again, a disease of aging, right? But we see this degradation at the end plates. We see the joints getting all ratchety and rough when they should be like the end plate should be nice and smooth. So let's talk a little bit about the disc, how urolithin A can help with degenerative disc disease and degenerative joint disease as well.
So a lot of research on the disc degeneration comes from other groups working on it. It doesn't specifically come from us, but what they are saying or they published, that we reviewed in this paper that you talk about in Cell, is essentially that even if you look at whether it's an osteoarthritic joint or intervertebral disc degeneration setting, the hallmark people are seeing is a decline in autophagy and mitophagy, right? That is happening. And by giving supplementation with urolithin A, you're boosting mitophagy. And that leads to, again, two things, which I think is a central hallmark, whether you're talking about muscle joints or brain,
like any example. System is coming back to the one thing. Yeah.
Two. It's the mitochondria and it's the inflammation. And it's the same thing happening in the joints. The joints are inflamed. What we see is a lot of cytokines. So these are soluble markers of inflammation. And we see a lot of these matrix metalloproteinases, which is linked to collagen assembly as well, getting degraded in the joint. And so by supplementing with urolithin A, we are recovering a lot of these biomarkers. And we see increase in autophagy, less pain. So another finding we are seeing, and these are collaborations we did with on osteoarthritis with the Scripps Institute in La Jolla, they actually saw less pain in the joints. They saw better mobility and less inflammation. So, but at the hallmark is upregulation of mitophagy. So I think that's the central tenet.
I love that so much because that bleeds into so many others. So if you have less pain and more mobility, that means that your range of motion or the joint capacity for range of motion is being restored, which means you can go to the gym and you can lift some weights without pain, right? Maybe you lift lighter weights, but then you're able to sort of get back in there. So those two things really play off of each other, really like the skeletal health and the joint health and the tendon health, as well as the muscular health as well, which I love. You mentioned collagen, and I think it would be remiss if we didn't talk about skincare. And one of the things that obviously that all, you know, as a, like, I am a vain woman. Like, I want to make sure that my skin looks as good as it can for as long as it can, is one of the things that we see with aging, of course, is fine lines and wrinkles, degradation in collagen in the skin, elastin in the skin, the hydration of the skin, you know, with declining estrogen as we age also tends to be an issue. Talk a little bit about, and then I would like to talk about some of the facial products that I have been using, by the way, and loving, but we'll get to that in a minute. Talk about how Urolithin A can help with our skincare as we're in our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond.
We got into skincare for two reasons, because I was sick and tired of people asking me, what am I going to feel with the oral products? I mean, how do I measure mitochondrial health? What do I see every day when I wake up in the mirror? And I was like, okay. So probably the first impact people see of aging is, as you rightly pointed out, is visual, right? So we started actually looking into the skin of 20-year-olds, 30, 40s, all the way to 60. And what struck us again there was that if you looked at the skin cells of a 20-year-old person versus a 60-year-old person or a 70-year-old person, was impaired mitochondrial energy. So impaired cellular energy was leading to things like impaired collagen assembly in the skin, leading to wrinkle formation. And this is skin is also one of the biggest organs for immune cells. People forget that as well. And so this has sort of pointed us that maybe if we actually made a topical product, we could directly hit rather than relying on, let's say, oral product, which probably would get into the skin and do something. But we wanted to make very direct sort of delivery mechanisms. And so we started looking in. We did trials. We made formulations that we tested in multiple randomized trials and volunteers from, let's say, 40, 50, 60-year-olds. And what we see is that we hit two big pathways of skin aging. One is intrinsic skin aging, which is what I described to you. Basically, that's the loss of cellular energy and
the collagen. The matrix.
The matrix. So we see an upregulation of mitochondrial energy in the skin, and we see an upregulation of all the collagen-related genes that decline with aging. So sort of hinting that the collagen framework is more strengthened, albeit, I guess, through to mitochondrial repair. And the second we think see, which is probably 70 to 80% of the aging, which is extrinsic aging, which is basically the aging happening because older of, you know, the photo, what we call photo aging, or the skin getting exposed to pollutants and skin irritants. And so what we did there was we actually induced moderate sunburn in the back of the skin of the volunteers, and we applied patches of the skin creams. And we see a reduction in redness and in the sort of the, you know, the erythema, what we call, which is basically a hallmark of photo damage.
Like those X-ray pictures that, you know, when you know, the sort of I always see with skincare products, they're like, look at the before and after. And they sort of have this almost X-ray of the skin where you can see the skin damage underneath the skin under this light versus not. That's what you're describing.
Yeah, you can see where the skin is inflamed, where the redness is set in. So which redness meaning your skin is sort of in a wounded form, and now it's trying to recover from the harmful photo damage. And so we see about a 15% reduction, which is huge. It's as good as probably putting a steroid cream to reduce your sunburn. And so that led us, those clinical data, which we just recently published, and it's under review right now, and also in JAMA Dermatology, that led us to the skincare products. So we developed products that then we independently clinically validated. And this is in a whole range of day and night cream and serum, and that, again, contains very calibrated dose of mitochondria.
Yeah, and I will say I've been using the day cream and the night cream pretty religiously, and there is a noticeable difference. Particular for, like, you know, I'm in my 40s, so now, like, I have little smile lines, like the little sort of what are, I guess they would be called crow's feet, you know, like those things that I'm like, oh, it's starting to creep up, starting to see those things. I am starting to see a difference in them. Now, I haven't actually, what I should have done, which I didn't, was taken a before picture, but I've been using it relatively consistently and absolutely love them. So we'll make sure that there's a link.
Yeah, so we see that in the trials. We see the focus on the crow's feet wrinkles, and we see about a 10 to 20% reduction depending on the different creams. And we see a boost in skin hydration. So we see that the skin barrier per se is much strengthened.
Yeah. Love that. All right. One more area I want to talk about, because I know everybody, you know, especially in the past couple of years, has been sort of focused on, is the immune system. So you were talking about the skin being one of the primary barriers, right? When we are encountering pathogens, viruses, bacteria, parasites, fungi, whatever. The skin is one of the primary sort of barriers, which is why the skin elasticity or that skin barrier is really important. What are some of the observations, if any, have we seen? So we've been talking about this mitochondrial function being the through line for all the systemic improvements. So we've talked about muscle and joints and inflammation and all of the things. What are some of the things specifically that we see in immune cells? You know, whether it's the adaptive immune system, it's the innate immune system. What are some of the changes that we're seeing with urolithin A supplementation on our immunity or our capacity for our immune function?
I'm a trained immunologist, and for long I believed that that there's a close mix between mitochondria and the immune status of an individual. And so what we started doing was we started looking at different age populations in terms of their mitochondrial health of the immune cells. And so what became very clear is, again, most people know as we all age, similar to the muscle trajectory, your immune system loses its ability, right? So that's why you don't respond as good to vaccination, or you catch more, let's say, flu or other kind of diseases in your 60s and 70s.
Or even just the cytokine storm that we were hearing about. The immune system just doesn't know what to do, so it overcompensates and goes nuts. Yeah.
Autoimmune diseases, cancer, typically these are all immune diseases, tend to happen more as we all age. It's because the whole immune system gets deregulated. So what we see is primarily two things. One is we boost this small subset of immune cells, and these are called as memory T cells. So they are self-renewing immune cells. And so they're kind of like your stem cells, but restricted to the immune cell population. And they have this intrinsic ability to renew at a very fast rate. So if you maintain this pool or you increase this pool, you can fight infections better. You can fight potentially cancer better. And so one of the big findings that, again, we published last year in a cell journal called Immunity was that urolithin A supplementation led to a dramatic, significant increase in these stem cell memory T cells. And that's these immune cells that are, right now, if you look, are one of the holy grails of even cancer immunotherapies, because everybody is trying to boost this small population of memory stem cell T cells. The second effect we see is more sort of on the immune exhaustion. Now, as we all age, our immune cells just get exhausted. They put these markers on their cell surface saying you're tired. You can't just keep dividing and fighting off. And that's why this whole field of aging or immune aging, they call it this sort of immune exhaustion happening. And so what we see is basically urolithin A supplementation can dampen these markers of immune exhaustion, suggesting that the immune cells remain in a more youthful status so during the aging process. So these are sort of the two areas where we are working on. We are doing two large trials, one in Germany where results probably come in early next year, is looking at this stem cell memory, and then we're running another trial in people who have beaten cancer, so they recovered with cancer, but because the immune system is recovering after getting a beating from cancer, how fast we can reseed their immune system with urolithin A supplementation. So these are the two areas we're working on.
And what are we looking for? Is it the number? So we were talking before about mitochondrial function, and you were saying the sort of three categories or three buckets that urolithin A can modulate is the number of mitochondria, the efficiency of them, and then the ability to induce mitophagy. Is it?
Yeah.
For the in the immune system specifically, are we looking
it's
for...
It's mitophagy again. It's mitophagy.
It's mitophagy. So it's that immune exhaustion, let's say. Is it getting rid of those exhausted cells and then maybe hopefully producing new fresh ones that are...
Yeah. So there's impaired mitophagy happening in these exhausted. When you rev up, the immune system gets cleaned away from these exhausted immune cells, and then that allows newer immune cells, healthier immune cells with better function to come in. And on the other spectrum, you know, if you're boosting this sort of these very youthful stem immune cells and you boost the numbers, then the reseeding of the immune system happens even better. So kind of combining similar concepts of improving mitophagy, but on two different immune cells.
And with those exhausted immune cells, is this, would you categorize these as senescent cells, like sort of those zombie cells that are like not quite dead, not quite alive, but they're hanging around causing all of this?
Yeah, I didn't want to use the geeky terms, but yeah.
You can geek out here, sir. You can geek out here, yes.
Yeah, so they are senescent zombie-like cells that kind of are hanging in, clogging your space, but not doing much.
Okay, so we've talked about T cells. What about B cells? So like humoral, what do we see any change on the humoral side?
Nah, I haven't looked deep enough, to be honest. We haven't looked at antibody responses to a flu vaccination or even a COVID vaccination. But these would be trials once we see the effect on the global. We are in this study that I mentioned, we are looking at T and B cells, mitochondrial health status after 4 weeks of immunization.
Yeah, that would be interesting too, because you mentioned the vaccination uptake or efficacy, let's say, in the older population. Part of that, even just for a younger person, is like the humoral, like the antibodies just get washed out after a while, which is why they're all calling for boosters all the time, right? Sure. So if there's a way to, if we can prolong the window with which those antibody, those B cells are around, I think that would be so interesting. I think that would be that's cool.
You'll have to invite me back next year when I have the event.
I would love that. Yeah. So we got some papers coming out that you're looking at right now with Stu Phillips. You got some, the German studies that you're looking at right now on immune cells. We are definitely going to have you back on. That is awesome. All right. So we've been talking about all of these different systems. And as we've sort of said a couple of times now, it really does come down to mitochondrial function and taking about 500 milligrams of urolithin A, at least at a minimum on a daily basis, seems to be the sort of minimum effective dose that's going to affect some of these changes that we're seeing. The only other question that I have, and this is just like my clinical hat on, is are there risks? Like, we've talked about 500 milligrams to a gram daily. Can you overdo it? Like, are there risks to over-supplementation, or does there not seem to be any risks on the upside?
So, two answers to that question. One is this is a natural molecule. By definition, most natural molecules derived in nature are extremely safe. As I mentioned, you can get exposed to this molecule if you're the right gut microbiome and eating right. So a lot of healthy individuals.
And you're living in Portugal.
And you're living in
or Italy or something.
Or eating the Mediterranean diet, which, by the way, has been shown to people in the Mediterranean diet have higher urolithin A levels. Yeah. So I think just this history of use. What we have done is we have done a very thorough safety evaluation that we have also vetted with the FDA. This is the designation that you get with the FDA. That's called the GRAS, which is generally regarded as safe. So you submit all kinds of tox studies and they were all clean. Basically, there is no, usually food ingredients need to have a NOEL, which is no observed adverse effect. Yeah. And it was hard to establish because you kept increasing to a certain amount where you could not give 100% of the diet is only urolithin A. And so now in humans, we've done about 7 to 8 different trials and there are multiple running, 1,000 participants roughly, no product-related adverse events so far, up to a gram dose. Now, we did a dose escalation study, much like taking 250, 500 gram and 2 grams in healthy older adults. And you kind of can keep increasing the absorption and the bioavailability. So what we see, and that's why we settle on the 500 milligram to a gram dose, is that after a gram, you kind of plateau the absorption. So the body can, and you can imagine, probably this is the evolution way of, you can drink 10 glasses of pomegranate juice, right? So it's kind of probably nature's way of plateauing out what is an efficacious dose. And so I don't think you can overdose it because even if you took the double dose, the absorption you'll see is the same as a gram with a 2 gram, because that's what our data is showing. So yeah, history of use, knowing the absorption profile, I don't think there's any safety. And we have 35,000 customers today and we don't think there's any adverse effect associated with this molecule.
Yeah, I ask that because, sometimes we get really hung up on, so for example, you'll see in the online space, like you have to walk 20,000 steps a day. And it's like, well, the there's diminishing returns at some point, right? Like you're still going to get benefit at 20,000, but you're going to get most of the benefit at eight, you know? So if you can walk 8,000 steps a day, you're going to get 85 to 90% of the benefits of walking for 20,000 steps, right? You're still going to get more benefits at 20,000, but like the amount of return that you're going to get is reduced. And that's where my question was really based on is like, is there an upper limit? Do we see any toxicity? I think the answer there is no. And, you know, maybe there can be a therapeutic intervention with a higher amount for sort of a defined period of time. And then you can kind of get back to the sort of maintenance level of 500 milligrams daily, let's say.
Perfectly put. I you know, that's sometimes when somebody, an older person, say they'll have difficulties moving. I always suggest take the higher dose, the gram dose, because we've seen better efficacy data. Stick to it for a couple of months, and then you can taper it down as like a maintenance dose. And I mean, we've had a lot of folks where nothing is working, they swear by it. So I think that's the right approach.
And I will just give a plug for the environment. The product itself comes in a glass jar, which is way better than a plastic bottle. And it, you know, the supplements themselves come in this sort of, I guess it would be air-packed container, which is really great for travel. So if you're not taking the glass bottle, let's say, with you when you're traveling, you can just take that, you can take that airtight bag that it comes in. And then if you're, you know, you're going to be at home, then you can just refill the glass bottle instead of throwing the bottle out and then buying a new bottle consistently and like polluting and all that. So I just want to do a little plug because you've also thought about the environment there as well, which I really appreciate.
And the other thing I'd like to add on is we've thought also about the product range. A lot of people I know like to pop pills, but there are folks who like to have, you know, their daily routine with shakes and smoothies. And so we have this option of the fruit flavored powders
that contain
the same dose, and you can, you know, blend it with your smoothie. And a lot of people like to, you know, kind of bring this diet focused approach, and you can blend it there. But we also have a protein shake that gives high 20 grams of whey protein plus Urotene or MitoPure. It's essentially the same, the trade name is MitoPure. So yeah, you know, people do have a whole range. And if anyone of your listeners or you want to try our test to see if you're producing your Urotene naturally, I can help you with that.
Wonderful. All right. So tell us where we can find, what are the websites if people have questions, maybe for you or your team, where they can buy the product. I would love for you to just share that if you can.
Sure. Folks can go to timelinenutrition.com. So that's the primary website to learn more about the products and the science. But if you want to really dive deeper into the science, you can go also to mitopure.com. That's where we have all the emerging signs and literature around longevity we talked about.
Great. It has been such a pleasure to speak to you, Doc. Thank you so much for your time, for your scientific research. And one of the things I really appreciate about a supplement company is the R&D that they put in, like the research and development into it. There's a lot of, we'll just say, you know, I mean, it's an unregulated industry for the most part. So people can just sort of slap a label on it. You can test it.
Sure.
And, you know, what's in the pill is not actually what's on the bottle label. So I just wanted to give a shout out to you and the commitment to excellence, which is a core value of mine in terms of putting out quality research and a quality product. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks for having me, Sydney. Thanks so much.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.